listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, things like Mary Jane's, Chuckles, Sugar Daddies, and more. Whether those old-time candies were the last thing you ate out of your Halloween candy, or maybe they're ones you shared with your own kids, we'll ask you to call in and share your nostalgic candy memories. That's coming up next. First, while the Me Too movement continues to reveal cases of sexual assault and harassment for prominent celebrities and media and entertainment stars, it's not so clear what the movement looks like for people in less high-profile workplaces. Our next guest talked to women from many different lines of work about their experiences with sexual abuse and harassment. Bernice Yearing is a reporter for ProPublica covering labor and employment. She recently wrote The Unreckoned, 17 Women Tell Why Me Too Still Hasn't Come for Them for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting in collaboration with New York Magazine. Her latest book is In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. Bernice, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You covered a lot of different types of workplace. Can you give us a sense of the range of workplaces you talk to women at?
Absolutely. I worked with a great team of reporters over at New York Magazine, and we reached out to hospital technicians, construction workers, theme park actresses, nannies, oil rig drivers, tech entrepreneurs, a really wide range of women in the workforce.
And one common theme among the women that you and the team talk to seems to be the Me Too movement, in the sense that it's opening the door for women to report cases of harassment and abuse and assault. It doesn't seem to have reached into these different kinds of workplaces.
As you know, one government public employee said to us, you know, she's really excited that this reckoning has come. And, you know, for her, it's a long time overdue, and she's glad that the taboo is being broken. But she really does wonder, you know, what does Me Too mean for her personally in her job, where she's dealing with some ongoing sexual harassment from her supervisor, you know, where the media and the public is not fascinated with her boss because neither she nor her boss are famous.
And I want to look at some of the other stories you heard. These are, I believe, pseudonyms. Roseanne, 44 years old, a technology entrepreneur, often, as entrepreneurs are, trying to get funding for companies. What kind of stories did she tell you about harassment that she had to deal with?
Well, she was taking meetings with venture capitalists trying to fundraise for her startup. And unfortunately, during one of those meetings, you know, essentially one of the funders made some really inappropriate comments. There were women in the room with them, and nobody said anything. And she tried to take it upon herself to do something about it, and she went to the VC firm and, you know, made it clear that she was not happy with that kind of sexual harassment happening in a business meeting. And the response was, well, you know, he has Tourette's. You know, he can't help himself. And she was thinking to herself, well, you know, clearly if he has a medical condition, that's one thing. But to her, really, the response felt like an effort to ignore what was actually happening. And so she ended up not getting invited in the future to other types of you know, VC meetings and other types of networking events, and she basically had to leave hundreds of thousands of dollars on the table simply because, you know, when she tried to say something, there was basically a blackballing effect.
And that seems to be a common theme, too, that you heard from women in a wide variety of fields of work, that in some cases they're explicitly told. I think a police officer that your team had talked to, they're explicitly told things will be worse for you if you do report it.
That's right. You know, she was dealing with all sorts of just incredibly immature and really hurtful behavior, including, you know, at one point, one of her superiors put up posters around the office and in the precinct saying that she had had relations with another officer, which was not true. She was mortified. And again, it was a superior who did this. And so she tried to seek recourse. She asked around and sought advice. And the advice that she got back was, well, you know, actually, if you say anything, it'll probably get worse for you. So I probably would suggest that you don't say anything at all. And as she put it eloquently, I think, she said, this is a place where snitches get stitches is not just a saying. So she felt like there was a lot on the line for her, and she never did say anything.
Talking to Bernice Jung about the Me Too movement and how it maybe hasn't reached all workplaces in the United States. She and a team talked to women in a wide variety of workplaces, high-paying, low-paying, at all points in between, and heard their stories. Now, you talked to a woman in the oil industry. Getting some noise in the background there. Okay. You talked to a woman in the oil industry who said she was raped by a man who had 15 years in the industry, a reputation. What were her thoughts on her experience and the Me Too movement?
You know, she was a single mother with three children, and someone told her that taking a job as basically hauling water for the oil industry and the oil fields was a really great way to, you know, earn a good living. And she had to go and basically find a place. There were regular places where you go to kind of to dump your water at the end of the day. And so one day she did that. She went to go use the restroom, and that's where she was physically attacked by a veteran oil rig driver. And he basically told her, you know, if you say anything about this, I'm going to deny it, and no one will believe you. And so she had to just kind of internalize a lot of that. And interestingly, as someone out in the oil fields and then driving trucks cross country, when I asked her about how she felt about Me Too, she said she had never actually heard about it. It was not something that she had encountered, and it was not something that had, you know, drastically affected her life. But I think also her story is really interesting because I think it's an important point that even though a lot of the women that we spoke to, and this is really just a subset of the dozens of women who were willing to share their stories with us, you know, just because they didn't feel that they could immediately come forward or make a formal complaint, whether to the government or to their employer, doesn't mean that they were being passive in how they responded to the violence or to the harassment. You know, they were constantly looking for other strategies to really address the issues that they were dealing with at work, whether it was changing their work patterns so that they would avoid the harasser, sometimes even changing their appearance. This particular oil rig driver, she actually ended up not going back to that same location ever again to do her business. And she started carrying a taser with her, and she got a little dog to travel with her when she was out in the field. And so, you know, I think it's an important point that it is extremely difficult to expect, you know, workers who have been wronged in this way to just easily come forward. But it's not because they're sitting around and doing nothing about it. They're really actively seeking strategies to avoid and curb the harassment and violence.
I want to wrap up looking at something we've talked to you about before. Women who are extremely vulnerable positions, women who are immigrants, documented or otherwise, who are very dependent in one way or another on their current employer and really have almost no recourse to report any kind of sexual harassment or assault. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. We spoke to a domestic worker and a factory worker, as well as a farm worker. And, you know, those are occupations that I've looked very closely at in my book. And, you know, for those women who are in low-wage jobs, who might come from an immigrant background where language barriers might exist, and then also, you know, immigration status might be tenuous, they are in a particularly vulnerable spot because leaving a job is just not something that they can really quickly and immediately do. They're making constant financial and practical calculations around, you know, the sacrifice that they're going to make on their paycheck while they're trying to support their families, both here and sometimes abroad. And they're also concerned about threats to their immigration status because sometimes threats of deportation are used to not only coerce them into unwanted sexual behavior, but then it's used against them in order to keep them silent. So, the barriers are quite formidable for workers in that particular context.
And as we wrap up, Bernice, it seems like, sitting here in a media position that the Me Too movement is all over. It's this huge development. It seems like everything has changed in some ways. It sounds like going out and talking to women again across the work spectrum, very little has changed in a lot of ways.
Well, I think there's a great willingness to talk about it in a more robust way, an opening certainly, that we haven't seen before. A lot of, coming together by women workers and others who've experienced this problem to support each other and really, look the issue in the eye and try to confront it. And I think that's really new. I think what we haven't really grappled with and come to terms with is actually what is the best way to respond? How do we actually prevent this instead of just expecting, injured workers to come forward and say something after the fact, after they've already been abused? And I think that's really where we need to start to kind of pivot is what is the prevention strategy here? What are we going to do to actually make sure that this doesn't happen?
Bernice, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bernice Jung is a reporter and author of In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. First, depending on your age, your memories of old-time candy may take place in different settings. Whether it was grandma's candy jar, the corner store, or maybe the candy you always ate last at Halloween time, you might remember Tootsie Rolls, not so old, Dots, Charleston Chews, Mary Janes, and more. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite older candy that you don't seem to see so much anymore? What's an old candy that was always around but you never really liked? Do you have some nostalgic memories of older candies? Call in with your opinions from Chuckles to Necco Wafers to Abba Zabba. I just saw that name. I don't know what it is. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Marnie Schur is a writer and contributor to The Takeout and the editor of the AV Club's Podmass column. She recently wrote a piece called A Guide to Old-Timey Candies for Our Modern Times as an installment of Old Folks Food Week on The Takeout. Marnie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what led you, Marnie, to want to explore the world of more old-time candies?
Well, the wonderful editors at The Takeout are excellent at theming their weeks of content. And for Old Folks Food Week, it just seemed like a natural progression to talk about candies that might get categorized as old people candy and then really investigate whether that's a fair assessment or whether these things deserve more of a designation as being timeless candy. So it was very fun to eat my way through the research on this one.
And you tried some of these. You were skeptical about a lot of them. Before we get into particular ones, you had some misses that weren't so good. You had some hits that you were surprised you liked.
I was just shocked at how many of these flavors still hold up, actually.
Well, I want to start digging into particular ones now. Here's one that I think you weren't so wild about, if I'm reading things right. The Necco Wafer. Now, this one, talk about old-timey. This one debuted in 1847. So this has got a long tradition. I will say my family, for some reason, when I was a kid, went through this Necco phase. But anything anybody says bad about them, I could agree. Talk about the Necco.
Well, they have their ardent defenders as well as their detractors, that's for sure. And it seems like everybody has an opinion one way or the other. The interesting thing about the Necco is that it really is this flavor frozen in time. You would never see a new manufacturer creating flavors of this type. And the consistency is just as important as the individual varieties within a Necco roll. I personally found them to be, chalky, crumbly. But if you're just looking to make your candy last, then something that you can suck on for a long time makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I loved them and they were chalky. And yeah, you had the risk of a shard just like piercing your mouth as it broke up. But there's, I don't know, once you start eating them. And yeah, there are fans who are worried that they're going to stop making them, I think. So would you go back now and eat another Necco or is that off your list?
Well, my roll did not include any of the much celebrated chocolate Necco, so I'd love to go back and try one of those because maybe I've been a little harsh before trying that one.
All right, now, and you've got some that I wasn't familiar with, dating back to 1895 now, Getz's Caramel Creams. Maybe I've seen these and didn't know what they were. I don't know.
Yeah, they're individually wrapped caramels with a cream center, and it's like a lot of old-time candy. If you get a fresh one, it's amazing. If you get a stale one, still pretty good, but a little different. Might take your fillings out more if it's a stale one, but yeah, it's delicious. It's I'm not a caramel fan, but it really won me over because it's got an almost Oreo-like cream in the center.
Okay. The Oreo cream might sell me on that. I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Nancy with us in Eagle River. Nancy, what's your old-time candy?
Razzles.
Razzles. What are those?
It's little round candy, and they're the size of a dime, and they got, like, little ridges on them. And when you chew them, the more you eat them, they turn into, like, gum.
Candy that turns into gum.
Yeah, at first it tastes like a powder, kind of like a sweet tart powder, but as you chew them, it's actually gum.
Okay. Nancy, thanks for sharing that. I don't think I've had that. I don't think I necessarily want to have it, Marnie. Is this one you included in your test or have run across before?
I've definitely run across it before, and Razzles have some of the biggest fans I know. It's a little bizarre, but once you get used to it, it's pretty tasty.
Thanks a lot for that call. Nancy, we're talking about old-timey candies. Our guest, Marnie Schur, went back and tried a bunch of them. She's rating them for us. Let's listen to a jingle for another one you tried. Oh, our volume's a little bit low there, but that's a Bit of Honey, a commercial going back to 1924. Bit of Honey, I just like imagine my teeth being stuck together, Marnie.
Yeah, I was surprised that I liked Bit of Honey as much as I did. I had never had it before, but something about that almond flavor was just so unique to me. And luckily for me, I got a nice fresh one, so I wasn't sticking my teeth together on it. And I chewed very slowly to keep my fillings intact.
And on a related note, speaking of mouths being shut together, I don't think of the Tootsie Roll as old-timey. Maybe I'm a little older than you. I don't know. I definitely had a Tootsie Roll phase when I was a kid, though. How did those stand up in 2018?
Well, I never liked them that much growing up. Maybe it's something about having to pretty constantly go to the Tootsie Roll factory on field trips outside of Chicago as a kid. You get a little tired of them. But now I see the kind of sophisticated flavor. It's not quite what you'd call chocolate. It's a little more earthy. It's got some molasses-type spice to it. So I think that as I grow older, I'll only like Tootsie Rolls more and more.
And I've gone in the opposite direction, I think. Again, I think because of the chewiness. We've got Tom on the line now in Pewaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. One of my favorites was candy raisins. They disappeared for a lot of years. They've tried to bring them back. They're not quite the same as they used to be, but candy raisins were my favorite old-time candy.
And these are raisins. I feel like I've had these. What are they coated with, Tom?
There's no raisins in them.
Oh, okay.
They're a little kind of gumdrop-shaped candy that maybe has a little bit of a ginger flavor to them. I can't really describe
okay.
the flavor. They're called candy raisins, but no raisins.
Okay, I lied. I have not encountered these. I thought they were just some kind of, like, something-covered raisin. Candy raisins that aren't really raisins, Marnie, is that on your radar?
I've never heard of these before. This is exciting to me. I'm going to have to track them down.
Okay, Tom, we've got Vern now in Boyd. Vern, what do you got for us?
Yeah, there used to be a candy store on the way to my grade school, and we had candy raisins.
Oh.
It was kind of a lightish brown, probably a half inch high, to kind of almost not like a pyramid, but kind of a rounded pyramid-like, and you get like five for a penny or whatever it was. But yeah, they called them candy raisins, but they didn't have any raisins in them.
Okay, candy raisin. And did you have one more for us, Vern?
Well, I used to buy the baseball card, and you get a piece of bubble gum with it,
You
got that for a penny.
Vern, thanks a lot for the call. So there's more candy raisins. Maybe this could be a sequel piece. Those baseball, the Topps baseball card gum, like talk about dry and chalky, but man, I would chew those as well. Marnie, I want to get back to another one you wrote about. Let's talk about, Red Hots. Those were around when I was a kid. I like the spicy cinnamony ones. What did you think when you tried them?
Loved it. Very unique. Almost doesn't feel like you're eating candy, right? It's kind of more like you're freshening up. You're just distracting yourself with a nice burst of cinnamon. So it's nice to feel guilt-free about it. It doesn't really feel like you're eating candy.
And then there's the Atomic Fireballs, made by the same company you wrote.
Yes, a little more intense. A little bit more like something you could have a competition on the playground, who can keep it, you know, in your mouth longer without sweating.
Oh, yeah, I did that in grade school. I do remember that. Let's go to Dave on the line now in the North Woods. Dave, hi.
Hello.
What's your candy, Dave?
Brock's Cool Blue Mints. Brock's is still making candy, but they don't make the Cool Blue anymore.
Uh-oh. Is Brock's the one you used to be able to get at, like, Howard Johnson's and stuff?
He used to get them at probably the Kohl's food store, I think, before we went on family vacation.
Okay. Dave, thanks a lot. I do remember, I can't remember where I saw it, but I remember seeing the big display of Brock's candies. I think there's a wintergreen one I liked. Is that one you've seen, Marnie?
Not those specifically, but Brock's has a pretty good malted milk ball that rivals the Whopper, in my opinion.
I don't know if I ever had those. Let's bring on one more caller. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Mallow cups were always my favorite, and they still make them, but they don't make them as good because they're not filled as much and the filling is not as creamy, but they still do make them. But those were always one of my favorites.
Mallow cups. Cindy, thanks. I've heard a couple people now, Marnie, say they don't make them like they used to. Do you think that's a real problem, or do you think it's our nostalgia?
I think it's a little of both. Sometimes recipes do change, but in the case of Necco, for example, they've done a lot to change the recipe back because they changed it for a while and they noticed that people really missed those nostalgic flavors. So sometimes they do revert.
And as we wrap up, Marnie, of all the candies you tried, is there one that's in your power rotation of candies now?
I might have to pick up some more root beer barrels because their molasses spice anise flavor was just so unique to me.
We'll leave it there. Marnie, thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marnie Scherr is a writer and contributor to The Takeout and editor of the AV Club's Podmas column. She joins us to talk about her piece called A Guide to Old-Timey Candies for Our Modern Times. Now, since the election of Donald Trump in 2016, there's been a lot of attention paid to America's growing urban-rural divide. But our next guest says there's another significant divide that's getting less attention, the economic and social gap among cities themselves. As some cities get richer and richer, think places like San Francisco, Seattle, and New York, others, like Dayton, Ohio, are being left behind. That's where our guest has been reporting from, but Dayton's story is one that's been playing out in many mid-sized post-industrial cities across the country. Alec McGillis joins us now. He covers politics and government for ProPublica, where he recently wrote the piece, How Struggling Dayton, Ohio Reveals the Chasm Among American Cities. His story was produced in collaboration with Frontline. Their new documentary, Left Behind America, is available to stream at pbs.org. Alec, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, the urban-rural divide, that's gotten a lot of attention. What got you focused in on this divide between different kinds of American cities?
Well, it's something I've been kind of fixated on for quite a while now, just in my travels as around the country as a reporter. It's something that you just can't help but notice. If you move frequently between places like Seattle and Washington on the one hand, and then cities like the one I live in, Baltimore, and cities in the Midwest like Dayton, on the other hand, it's just really stark how big these differences in levels of prosperity and dynamism have become. We've always had richer and poorer cities in the country, of course, but the gaps have just gotten way bigger than they've ever been. If you just look at income numbers back in like 1980, there was much more parity between the sort of wealthier cities and the more kind of conventional ones, and now the wealthy cities have just gone off into the stratosphere in terms of their wealth and income levels. So it's something that I've really been fretting about as a journalist for some time now.
And what's driving that growing gap between, I think one of the stats you give is comparing Dayton, where you're focusing on, and San Francisco, almost double the per capita income in San Francisco to Dayton, much bigger than gaps had been, as you said, in the past. What's behind this?
Well, there's several drivers of it. One is the nature of the tech economy. So, back when the internet was first spreading, the thought was that, hey, this will be something that will allow us to kind of be to live and work anywhere we want, because we can be connected anywhere, and it'll just kind of allow wealth and jobs to kind of spread out. In fact, the opposite has happened. The nature of the tech industry is one that is that it rewards agglomeration. It's sort of a winner-take-all effect where it's become very clear that companies feel like they, in fact, need to be together, need to have their programmers and engineers all together to be innovating in one place. You want to be pitching your proposal to the venture capitalists in person. So you want to be near where they are. So there's this kind of winner-take-all effect to the tech economy, where it kind of all just flows to one or a couple places. Another part of it is the growing concentration in our economy. We have no secret that a whole bunch of industries are getting more and more concentrated in just a handful of companies. And so as the economy concentrates in certain companies, the wealth also concentrates in the cities where those companies are based. So as Google and Facebook dominate ad revenue, more and more wealth flows to the Bay Area where they're based. As Amazon more and more dominates retail, more wealth flows to Seattle where they're based. And finally, I think that it's worth thinking about the cultural, sort of social cultural aspect of the trend too. And it has a lot to do with the fact that people, highly mobile professionals are more looking for security, because you're less likely to work for one company now for your entire life. So you're going to go to a place where you can be guaranteed to find work in your line of business, even if the one job doesn't work out. So if you're looking for a job in biotech, you're going to go to Boston or San Diego instead of trying out this one intriguing job in Rochester or St. Louis, because you want to be where all the other jobs in that business are. So there are a whole bunch of different reasons for it, but it has become, I really think, one of the defining trends of our time.
Talking to Alec McGillis about his coverage of a growing divide among American cities, some big economic winners, many not doing so well. And I want to focus in now on your reporting on Dayton, Alec, though I'll say a lot of the elements of your story might sound familiar to people in Janesville or Kenosha or smaller cities that have lost a paper mill in Wisconsin. But paint us a picture of what Dayton is looking like these days.
So, Dayton is really a classic story of the industrial Midwest. It was a extraordinary hub of innovation and prosperity back in the early parts of the last century. One of the remarkable facts I came across in my years of reporting in Dayton is that, the city was claiming more patents per capita around the turn of the 20th century, in the late 1890s, thereabouts, than any other city in the country. So you had the Wright brothers, of course, but then you had all these other major industrial innovators and inventors, especially in the automotive realm. The company that the city was most famous for was National Cash Register, which made cash registers and later ATM machines and all sorts of other things. And so the city, goes through a very kind of typical industrial decline in the 70s, 80s, 90s, which was parallel to a very really big population decline. The city's lost almost half of its population, the city proper. But really, a lot of the real hits the city's taken have been pretty recent. The 2000s, the first decade of this century, were just brutal for Dayton, which likely traced large measure to China's being led into the WTO in 2000, which really hammered a lot of manufacturing areas. So the city lost just tons of auto-related jobs in the first decade of this century. And then National Cash Register left the city as well in 2009. So it took some real crushing blows. There are definitely signs of it coming back in certain areas. That it's downtown is seeing some upticks in downtown loft residences. It's still very fortunate to have a big Air Force base right on the edge of town. There are places that might be even worse off in Dayton right now, but the gap that has opened up between it and these sort of winner-take-all cities is just undeniable, and it's bigger than ever.
You mentioned the Great Recession, and it seems like with Dayton and from some of your other reporting, a lot of other cities, things they'd had problems leading up to that, but were kind of scraping by, and that the Great Recession was a last straw that Dayton and other places are still feeling the impacts of 10 years later.
Definitely, and then for Dayton, it was then rapidly followed by just this horrific opioid epidemic, which has hit Dayton really as hard as just about anywhere. The city has the good fortune of being right at the crossroads of two big interstates, 70 and 75, which has made it a real kind of like transport and logistics hub, but it also made it a really easy target for traffickers coming up from Mexico. You had a really high rates of prescription painkiller usage in the city as a result of its kind of blue-collar heritage, and then that very quickly transformed into heroin usage when they clamped down on the painkiller prescribing, and then fentanyl came in like an angel of death. And last year, and the city, in the first half of last year, the city was basically the highest in the country for per capita overdoses, just stunning figures. And they've turned somewhat of a corner now, hopefully, that there seems to be less fentanyl in the supply. But that has just been absolutely devastating for that area.
Yeah, you point out a contrast in your reporting on this, saying that, okay, while cities, as you were saying earlier, that are doing well, have this self-sustaining thing where they're successful and more people move there to join in that success. With the opioid story, once a city like Dayton starts to have an opioid problem, it brings in the distribution, and then people who are seeking the drug come into there. So it's this horrible self-sustaining negative thing going on.
Exactly. It's what I see all around me here in Baltimore, where I live. It's the same kind of thing where once a city gets its reputation for having a really plentiful drug supply, it brings in, you know, substance abuse, people who are suffering from substance abuse disorder. And it also, these cities also tend to have pretty strong safety net services, social services, shelters, food banks, soup kitchens, drug treatment centers, things that are often not available in the towns and suburbs around them. And so people also come into them seeking that kind of assistance. And so you just notice it in Dayton that a lot of the people you speak to who are panhandling on the corners or, you know, looking to buy drugs or at the shelters are actually not Daytonians from Dayton proper, but they've come to the town over the years because it has what they need.
We're talking right now to ProPublica reporter Alec McGillis about the growing economic and social divide among American cities. Alec's recent piece focuses on Dayton, Ohio, but he says it's a story that's playing out in similar cities all over the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you hearing the story of your city in one way or another? Do you live or have you lived in a place that's experiencing that sort of thing? The factories have closed, opioid problems, not seeing the success that some other cities are seeing. Or do you see some signs of hope if you're in a city like this? What's your city doing to attract new residents, maybe new businesses or new jobs being created? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with ProPublica reporter Alec McGillis. His recent piece is called How Struggling Dayton, Ohio Reveals the Chasm Among American Cities. It was produced in collaboration with Frontline. Their new documentary is Left Behind America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has the loss of manufacturing affected your town or city? Do you feel like the difference, the gaps between American cities, especially the bigger, thriving coastal cities and the Midwestern so-called Rust Belt cities, is being overlooked? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alec, as you mentioned, the population of Dayton went down, dropped by about half of its peak. But there was one sign of hope with immigrants, actually refugees coming into the city, moving into some of these inexpensive properties and starting businesses.
Yes, Dayton has made a concerted effort to make itself very welcome to immigrants and refugees, and as a result has been branded a sanctuary city by some folks on the right. But one of its successes in this regard is that it became a magnet for a fascinating community of little-known community of Russian Turks. They're ethnic Turks who centuries ago migrated to Russia and the former Soviet republics and were persecuted there and got refugee status last decade for a couple of years. And a whole bunch of them, about 2,000 of them, gravitated to Dayton mainly because it is so affordable there. And they have been incredibly successful there. They've become a force mainly in the trucking industry and have renovated whole swaths of the old north side of town and have gotten involved in politics and are really sort of a major player now in the city. You see them, they're so successful that a whole bunch of them have bought them very fancy cars. And you see them driving around Dayton, around the fairly sort of humble streets of Dayton in Maseratis and Porsches and Jaguars. It's just quite a sight.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andrew joins us from Appleton. Andrew, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you want to bring up?
I just think that not only in urban economies, but also in rural economies where I'm from, opioid epidemics have really skyrocketed. And in cities, I think that people recognize drug use as a problem and in many ways have more ways to deal with it via resources and funding. But in rural economies such as Rhinelander, where I'm originally from, it really seems like an under-addressed issue. Nobody really seems to talk about it, either because of stigma or stereotypes. People don't really recognize that rural areas have that drug rate problem, but it has really skyrocketed so much that in a population of about 5,000, it's nearly impossible to not interact with somebody or many people, for that matter, that have not been directly affected by this.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. It's definitely a common problems in some ways between cities, mid-sized cities like Dayton and rural areas. Alec, with the question of resources, one thing really stuck in my mind from the Frontline documentary. You're talking to, a medical examiner or a coroner, and he said they'd had to use some of the resources that they usually keep in reserve for mass casualty events just to keep up with the toll from opioids.
Yes, I mean, it has such a huge impact there. But the caller raises a really good point about the effect this has had in small towns, too. I did a whole other piece last year that was set in rural Ohio, rural southeast Ohio, Appalachian Ohio, and it was about the epidemic there. And one of the things that came through was just how, first of all, how hard the epidemic has hit there as well, but also just how unprepared the towns there are, both in terms of lack of resources, lack of treatment options, but also simply in terms of the mindset there in these small towns, where there was much greater resistance, for instance, to the quite effective treatment options that are for opiate addiction, which are effectively substitute opiates, methadone or buprenorphine, which are quite available in bigger cities, but are really, really hard to find in rural areas. And so the epidemic has just been so tremendously vast and devastating in ways that I don't think have yet fully registered in those winner-take-all cities where a lot of our sort of most influential kind of thought leaders reside. They have not, I think, fully absorbed how bad it's gotten in the mid-sized cities like Dayton and in the rural areas like rural Wisconsin.
Andrew, thanks for that call. We're talking to Alec McGillis about his reporting on a growing gap, a divide among American cities, the haves and have-nots. He focused in his reporting on Dayton, Ohio. Alec, one wrinkle, a new company opened up in the Dayton area you report on, a glass manufacturing company, I think it's Auto Glass, but owned by a Chinese manufacturer. Can you tell that story?
Yes, this is really quite a remarkable development. One of the big hits that Dayton took in the last decade was the closure of a huge GM plant just south of the city in 2008, right around the time of the financial collapse a decade ago, and more than several thousand jobs were gone just like that. And a few years ago, though, a Chinese company moved into that exact same plant and retrofitted it to make auto glass. And they now have more than 2,000 people working there, which on the one hand is good news for Dayton. On the other hand, the problem is that these jobs pay a lot less than those GM jobs used to. Workers are starting at about $15 an hour now. That's actually up from initially, it was just like $12 an hour. This is really difficult work. They've had a lot of workplace safety issues, and actually just a few months ago, a worker was crushed to death there. And so it's a sort of a comeback of manufacturing jobs in a way, but it's a different sort of job than the Dayton area was used to back when you could make $35 an hour working for GM.
Right. I was going to say, this is a common theme among the people you talk to. A worker saying, yeah, I used to average $35 an hour. Now there are these $15 an hour factory jobs. A couple you talked to, a guy talking about his parents were a chemist and a registered nurse. He and his family had just moved out of a homeless shelter, even though they were both working. The opportunities aren't there. The people who had middle-class parents do not have middle-class jobs available to them.
Right. You really kind of see this downward mobility present all around you. And it's reflected in the numbers. The city, there's a story in the local paper just a day or two ago that the city has still not gotten back to where its median incomes were before the crash. The jobs have come back just in terms of the unemployment rate, but the income and wage levels have not. And then meanwhile, so you have this kind of downward mobility that seems very present all around you. And then to the extent that there's upward mobility, it often involves, this is I think one of the key things for these kind of cities, it often involves people leaving. You have this real dynamic now where people, you know, the college-educated young people in a lot of these places, these cities, end up going elsewhere to pursue their careers. And you see, it's not just a matter of going to, you know, New York or the coasts. It's also a matter of going to sort of the regional winner cities. One thing you're seeing now is that even within regions, you have growing gaps between, like, the one city that's doing really well and then a whole bunch of others that are kind of falling behind. In Ohio, that city is Columbus. Columbus has just really kind of separated itself from a whole bunch of other cities in the state and is more and more kind of drawing young people, you know, who go to Columbus for Ohio State, and then they don't come back. And that's become a real problem in a lot of parts of the country where you have those kind of regional hub towns that kind of absorb the more ambitious, more higher educated young folks from smaller cities around the state.
Alec, we'll leave it there for now, but I hope we can talk to you about these issues in the future. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alec McGillis covers politics and government for ProPublica. We've been talking about his piece, How Struggling Dayton, Ohio Reveals the Chasm Among American Cities. There's also a Frontline documentary on this. It's called Left Behind America. It's available to stream at pbs.org.